ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I love that you've picked this song because On the Beach is my favorite Neil Young record.
Oh, very good. It says just a lot about you.
Does it?
Yeah.
Now you're going to start giving me therapy.
No, good taste.
Years ago, we met a band called Smashing Pumpkins. Rising in the wave of American grunge, the Chicago band were led by the iconic voice of Billy Corgan and would rise and rise like all their contemporaries over the coming years. I still remember the cover of Gish, perfectly 1991 with its fisheye image of the band and that purple haze. If you know anything about music history, you know the story of the Pumpkins is a tumultuous one, but Billy has continued through it all. Back in 2012, Billy Corgan was in Australia to play Splendour in the Grass with the latest incarnation of Smashing Pumpkins. With a new album under their belt, he was in a buoyant mood and up for an epic conversation when he joined me to Take Five. Billy is always good chat, but if you've ever wondered about the music that made him, this conversation is a dream. So settle in, don your flanny, and discover the songs that make Billy Corgan feel good. If we're talking about feelings as well, you've always put it all out for everyone to hear over all your records.
It's so early for this conversation.
You know what? The Take Five is often therapy, so strap yourself in, Billy. But I'm wondering if you can cast your mind back to the time when things weren't going so well for the Pumpkins and you still had to create
this
music.
Which year are we talking about here?
I'm sure there were a few different times in and out. How did you deal with still creating music when things weren't going so well with your friends and your collaborators within the band?
Well, I think in a way, if it makes any sense, that was the best part about being in the band was where we were able to transmute uncomfortability and unhappiness or feeling left out of certain conversations. We were able to take those feelings and translate that into an idealized way of presenting music. As long as it worked and it worked with the public, it was able to sort of feed back in and on itself. When it stopped being as effective with the public, then it sort of opened up the wounds because we weren't able to cover them up anymore. And so it was difficult, but a lot of compelling music, certainly. And it's amazing because not a day goes by now where I don't hear somebody connecting to some song from any number of the albums. And that's the beautiful part of the world about the world we live in now is anybody can find the songs anywhere. And the band just seems to grow on its own now. It's sort of its own garden.
And you've also got that beautiful ability to be able to get up on stage as you did at Splendour and as you have this week in Melbourne and Sydney and play out new music for your fans and old music and seeing these people who are, you know, in some cases 15, 20 years apart connecting across time and space.
I think the nice part about the generation that's there now, the 20-somethings that are now, they don't have any direct connection to the grunge era. If they look at it, they're looking at it on YouTube or something. Mm. They don't actually know what those gigs felt like. So if we can bring that energy into the room like we did at Splendour, I think they're getting something that they're probably not getting from their generation's bands. That's not to say that those bands have the same goals that we did, but there's a visceral quality and a shadowy quality to the music that we play that I don't see in a lot of modern bands.
Well, I want to talk about that because we are in the thick of resurgence. And as we do every 20 years, what is old is now new again. Oh, we're going to talk a little bit about that.
Am I new again?
No, you never went away, Billy. That's the thing.
God bless you.
Always continued. But I guess interesting, in fact, as we dive into this Take Five, because most of the songs, in fact, all of the songs that you've chosen for us, do hail from one particular decade that was kicking around 20 years before the 90s. We're talking about, of course, the 70s. If you can do math, you figure that out yourself. And we're going to dive into that now. Billy Corgan is with us, Taking Five, with the songs that make him feel good. 72 is the year we're beginning. You and I, or And You and I, is sometimes known as well, by a band called Yes. I'm not that familiar with Yes.
Oh, beautiful.
So give me a musical education, yeah. Indeed, the whole country. Why did you pick this song?
We'll start with Yes a little bit. Yes is one of those bands that was at the time considered a supergroup. Guys came from different places and formed this almost crazy band where everybody in the band was a gifted musician. And they wrote really interesting, unique music in an era where being this idiosyncratic could actually be popular and could produce hit songs. If you think about the song we're about to play, this was actually a big hit in America. It would be almost impossible to conceive of this song being a big hit now. So there was an openness in the time where any band coming from any perspective could have a hit song. And I think these bands were, in essence, drawn forward by that to really explore their music to its greatest depth and, in a way, become more individualistic as opposed to more collective, which is one of my great criticisms of music today. Yes is the type of band I believe if they came out today would still be very popular with this type of music. There's folk influences, prog influences, free jazz influences. The Renaissance is in there too. But really beautiful and really heartfelt music.
And they create a fantasy as well, somewhere that you can escape to.
Well, isn't that what it's all about?
I want to talk to you a little bit, Billy, about the beginnings of when you discovered music, because I'm seeing, obviously, with the selections today, there's a really heavy, epic, you know, prog, psychedelic and everything in between 70s influence, and it's only just begun, as I've said. But how did you discover this music in the first place? Because you didn't grow up in the 70s. Is this stuff that you were listening to from a young age?
Well, I was born in 1967, so I started listening to rock music when I was about 5 years old. For people who remember days before the internet, everything was word of mouth.
Mm.
You would hear songs on the radio, but even then, if you turned and told a friend, oh, I like this song, and if they, you know, said, oh, I don't like that band, you shouldn't listen to them, there was a lot of peer pressure, just like there is now, but it was more word of mouth peer pressure. A band like UFO, for example, and yes, they had great street credibility. I think it's hard in this modern era to explain what the kind of street credibility they had then, because those bands have been marginalized by history because they don't fit into certain niches, where a band like Velvet Underground perfectly fits in that niche that still exists, as they should. For fans of hard rock and heavy metal, UFO, for example, stands out as a very unique band, highly melodic, punk influences, different subject matter, and yet they're still good, basic, up-the-middle rock and roll band. This spawned bands in America like Boston and Cheap Trick, things like that. More melodic, heavy music that had big hits on the radio. So there was a sort of awareness where you could find a band on the radio and then turn around to your friends and your friends would say, I like that band's cool. There was nothing wrong about being on the radio in that way.
Mm.
Bands didn't feel like they had to be cooler than to get somewhere. They just were who they were. And if they were nerdy, sometimes it worked. If they were geeky, sometimes it worked. There weren't these niche enclaves of coolness like we have now.
Do you think that we had that as well in the 90s when you were then turning around and becoming a fan to a music maker and there was still these cliques, these certain parts of the authentic side and the side that was after a commercial success?
Cliques are always going to exist, but I think when it becomes a business model, that's when any alternative-minded person should become suspicious.
Mm.
And, you know, quote-unquote hipster land has become a business model now. I saw plenty of kids, you know, at the airport leaving Splendor in the Grass, and although many of them were actually very handsome and attractive, they looked alike. I didn't see as much diversity as I would have seen in the 90s, nor as much diversity. I saw tons of diversity in the 80s because it wasn't codified. You couldn't go on the internet and see what it meant to look a certain way. You couldn't buy the right t-shirt from eBay or whatever. You kind of had to figure it out as you went along. I mean, if somebody could see a snapshot of me in 85, I look horrifically out of place, but that's sort of how I define myself. I had to kind of figure it out as I went along. The peer pressure systems were different. Musical peer pressure is always going to be there because there's always going to be somebody standing there that's cooler than you saying, oh, don't listen to that. Those guys are dumb.
When you mixed Siamese Dream all those years ago, you were quoted as saying that you had your 15-year-old self in mind. Do you still think back to that when you're making records today, thinking about what you'd love as a teenager?
No. Sorry. No, I don't. I'm in a different place in my life where I make music as a form of communication, and I've stopped assuming that the audience is a certain type of personality. I would say in the 1993 version of me, I had a very narrow band of who would actually listen to my group, and I had a picture in my mind. I'm amazed because as the world is opening up, I'm amazed how I receive Twitters and emails from people all over the world that you would never figure would relate to the music. And I think you've got to get out of that mindset that you're trying to appeal to a certain type of kid with a certain type of haircut, because music is a universal language, and done properly, it really is beyond race, classism, gender, sexual politics. It's a communication of the heart.
UFO, again, another musical education for me. I'd never heard of these bands, or this band in particular, before. Tell us about this song, Love to Love.
I actually covered this song for a movie called Spun, if anybody remembers that movie. UFO was one of those bands that came out of the hard rock scene in the UK in the mid-70s. What made UFO a little bit different is they actually had some punk rock influences, similar to the same type of influences that would, say, influence Iron Maiden. There was a punkiness, of course, the Sex Pistols and all the typical stuff you'd remember from the punk rock scene in the late 70s in the UK. Well, it actually influenced a British heavy metal as well. So UFO is more on the melodic side, where Iron Maiden would be more on the kind of the heavier side. UFO, for fans of guitar, this album features Michael Schenker, who is brother to Rudolf Schenker from the Scorpions, and at one point, Michael, the younger brother of Rudolf, was in the Scorpions. He left the Scorpions and became part of the supergroup called UFO, and they went on to have massive hits in the US, and this was one of them.
Two supergroups in a row.
It's all about the supergroup.
Well, you had a supergroup of sorts with Zwan.
Supergroup addicts, maybe.
I'm a big fan of Dave Pajo, so I was excited when I saw
him. I'm not a big fan of Dave Pajo.
Do you have any friends in your past bands? Do you stay friends with any people? Or
no.
Do too many clashings of personalities?
No. Well, look, you know, I'll just keep my mouth shut.
Okay. Well, there's been too many times and I can't go back. That buys guitars, run down motels like shacks. What amounts up to, I don't want it at all. Whilst you and I want you to. Let's jump into another epic, shall we? Where do you want to go next?
This artist, that you may have heard him, a little obscure, Neil Young.
Oh, that guy. I love that you've picked this song because On the Beach is my favorite Neil Young record.
Oh, very good. It says just a lot about you.
Does it?
Yeah.
No, you're going to start giving me therapy.
No, good taste.
It's a really beautiful record. Tell us why you picked this song in particular. It's the epic closing track. Ambulance Blues.
Well, let's real quickly address the record that you love so well. If you put this record in context, that's a record where Neil started to move away from the mainstream expectations of himself and getting a little bit more into folk music, a little bit more into the poetry of his music. And he was widely criticized at the time for doing it.
Mm.
You know, these are records that are critical for artists to make because ultimately they speak to people like you and I further down the road. Ambulance Blues is this great song. I don't really know exactly what it's about. It seems sort of like a sort of a stream of consciousness song, but he's certainly addressing Hollywood and the mainstream of America. And the funny thing is many of the lyrics could be completely relevant to today.
Back in the old folky days, air was magic when we played. The riverboat was rocking in the rain. Midnight was the time for the raid. Oh, Isabella, proud Isabella. They tore you down and plowed you under. You're only real with your makeup on. How could I see you and stay too long? All along the Navajo Trail, stub their toes on garbage.
He also has this ability, if we're talking about songs that make you feel good, the timbre of his voice is so sad.
But so I don't find Neil Young sad. But it's like when people say The Cure is sad. I don't get that.
Well, I mean, this is how I take it. But I guess more thinking more broadly about when you listen to music that has a sadness to it and that in turn makes you happy. Do you tend to do that sometimes? Are there some things where you just think, oh, God, I'm in a crap mood. I just need to put on a really sad record, a Tom Waits record, or in my case, a Neil Young record, and that makes you feel better? There's some sort of catharsis in that?
I would see it as certain artists will make you feel like they understand what you're going through, and that's where the relief comes through. Oftentimes, when we're in sorrow, we feel like no one really understands, and we turn to those artists that somehow they speak a higher language to say, wow, they kind of do understand what I'm going through. You know, I made an album, Adore, in 1998 after my mother passed away, and widely misunderstood at the time. And I get compliments all the time now because when people lose something, they say, oh, now I understand that record in a way that I didn't before. And that's a great compliment that they were able to turn to that record and understand the language that I was speaking. Because loss, for example, is not always a pure negative. When we lose somebody that we really love, of course, we reflect very deeply on the things that they gave us, the gifts they brought into our life. So sorrow in and of itself is a reflective process, but it's born of a desire to want something better. If you just accepted what you had, well, you'd never be sad, you know?
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on.
10.
Ground control
9,
to Major Tom.
8, 7, 6.
Commencing
5,
countdown, engines on.
3, 2.
Check ignition
1,
and may God's love be
off
with you.
Space Oddity is a definitive song of alienation. He goes into space. There's this communication, ground control to Major Tom. You know, put your helmet on, take your protein pills. Okay, I'm stepping out into space, and it's all very optimistic. He's floating around the Earth. Wait, ground control, there's a problem. We've lost your signal. And, of course, then you go back to the astronaut floating in space who doesn't realize he's lost connection. You know, it's a beautiful, in a way, prescient dissertation on what we're going through now with technology, where we have this incredible communication possible.
Planet Earth is blue, and there's nothing I can do.
A I mean, here I am in Australia. I'm constantly texting and emailing people around the globe. Mm. I have a friend in Thailand that I've been talking to. I have a friend in Europe I've been talking to. I have a friend back in Chicago I'm talking to. I'm able to be connected to the entire world simultaneously. Yet, the minute I think I lose that phone, I go into a panic attack like I just did 20 minutes ago. Or, you know, if you have a problem, like when we first landed here in Australia, our phones weren't working properly. You go through this weird anxiety, but yet it's all psychological because, of course, we're always connected to the people we love. So I think this song really speaks to this kind of thing we're going through where we're incredibly connected and yet we're becoming disassociated in a way that we've never been before. Ground control to Major Tom, your circuit's dead. There's something wrong.
And those themes, though, existed. Well, that song was written in the time before all of this technology. So do you think those themes are always going to exist, no matter what the actual, you know, the method is, the medium, that we'll always have that feeling of connection and disconnection, no matter what we're dealing with?
Well, when you look at the emerging technologies that are coming out of science, where they're talking about being able to implant chips in people's brain, holographic technology, you know, even the porn industry is, of course, looking forward to the time when people will be able to have virtual reality sexual experiences. Can you imagine the money that's there? Not that I would participate, but
I'm still in Tupac's hologram at Coachella and then thinking about that in a porn sense, and it's kind of...
Well, but okay, but let's take that into the, back in the music. I mean, are we going to see now holographic Beatles, holographic, you know, whomever?
How do you feel about that?
I don't really have a problem with it. To this degree, people should celebrate the things they love. Mm. I have a problem with this mawkish sentimentality that's going on where the past suddenly becomes really attractive when there's no other good business model. You know, we've all seen the shrinking of the music industry as a whole, and it's really struggled in embracing technologies. Well, holographic technology is something that the music business probably should have gotten around to about 10 or 20 years ago. Music business is loath to embrace technology because it means they have to turn the control over to other people. Mm. Music is usually peer-to-peer. The artist makes the record, hands it in the label. But the movie business, look at how they've embraced CGI. I just see that as just another way to reach people. If you're a Beatles fan, and of course, you know, you're 15 years old, and you're, of course, never going to get a chance to see the Beatles, maybe you can go see Paul McCartney or Ringo Starr play. Unfortunately, two of the Beatles have passed away. If you can experience something of the essence of the 1964 Beatles, I don't see anything that's wrong with that, because you're always going to get something because the music is so powerful. As long as the music is the center of the argument, I have no problem with it. It's when sentimentality becomes the center of the argument, selling cell phones becomes the center of the argument, that's where you lose me, because music is sacred and everything else around it just isn't.
When you talk about that sentimentality, particularly with people who had never experienced it before, what's your take on that, on this resurgence of 90s music and influences, and particularly given that a lot of the music that we're listening to today has been firmly, you know, from 20 years before the 90s, as I mentioned at the start of this Take Five, that 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Is it an okay thing to take the music of 20 years ago and use it as a motivation to create something fresh and new?
Absolutely. I mean, I did that. I have no problem with that. It's when it becomes an avoidance of progress.
So how are you going to progress, Billy Corgan?
Keep breaking myself in half.
And exposing yourself for everyone to hear.
Well, look, the journey of an artist, let's take Neil Young, for example. We were talking before about the On the Beach record, not a hugely successful record at the time. The journey of an artist, if they're truly an artist, whether you're Pablo Picasso or Neil Young, the real message of that artist, the deeper message, is probably going to be lost by 90 to 95% of the public as it's happening. So the artist has to deal with the backswell of, let's call it, the stupid part of the opinion. I don't like this song. I like Cinnamon Girl. I don't like this one. Da-da-da-da-da. The artist has to have enough internal fortitude to stay firmly rooted in their vision. And a visionary like Neil Young has been able to do that. Now, obviously, he wasn't able to do that on every record, at every moment. And I'm sure he looks back on something and says, oh, I got a little lost in that. The overall message of Neil Young is so much more powerful than whether or not you like an album, don't like an album, like a song, don't like a song. And that's what gets lost when you try to take a Neil Young and you try to reduce him down against to the guy who's doing nothing but just trying to pump out hit songs. That guy can't hang with the Neil Young. Neil Young could sit you in front of a campfire and blow your mind with just an acoustic guitar. That's why he's such a special artist. There's only so many people like that. There's only one Bruce Springsteen, one Neil Young, one David Bowie, one Tom Waits, you know, one Saint Vitus, right? We have to really learn to celebrate those special artists and stop asking them to play in the sandbox with the posers and the marginal talents who really only have one story to tell, and once they tell it, we discard them.
Mm.
Neil Young will tell you a 27-hour-long movie. And from my perspective in my musical life, I think the deeper message of the Smashing Pumpkins, the willfulness, the raconteur aspect, the brattiness, the stupidity, the willingness to embrace darkness, the willingness to make videos that no one had the balls to make. That's the bigger story and lesson of the Smashing Pumpkins. Whether or not you like some silly song I did or didn't write, that's a reductionist idea, where I'm in the expansive idea, which is my band will live on long past me, and hopefully somewhere in the digital ether will exist on for some alien to download and find something in the message. And they go, wow, Billy was ahead of his time by 4,000 years.
If we're still around then, fingers crossed.
Well, you will be. You will be.
Billy Corgan has been
with us. Your voice is now floating somewhere out there.
It's scary, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure that people are rocking out to some Smashing Pumpkins as well on some planet somewhere.
It's probably started a war on some distant galaxy.
We can only hope. No, we can't hope. Billy Corgan has been with us over the last little while. Five songs that make him feel good. And as you heard, they're a really big discussion of music on the whole, both his own and the music that he loves. That's why we love the Take Five so much, because it's a chance for artists who you love to walk you through some of their favorites and maybe even give you a musical education. So, Billy, thank you so much for playing us these epics.
Oh, thank you.
And taking us on this journey. And we're going to finish with an epic from another guy who, there is only one Lou Reed. He's continued to make music for so many years under so many guises. And Berlin is where we're going to end on. Very raw, this song and this album. 1973 is the year. Talk us through why you chose this song to end on, Billy Corgan.
Well, sometimes when you're having a bad day, kind of like we were talking about before, you have to listen to something that kind of relates to you. Well, Lou has a way of writing a song that's so sad that you just can't help but think, you know, I don't really want to throw myself off the roof today, because Lou's been there. He came back.
He's a survivor.
It doesn't get any sadder than this song.
This is something that he wrote having never been to Berlin, and yet you can feel it in every moment of this song, and yet it was made up. Do you feel like your music has to be written from experience, or you can take people into a fantasy?
No. In fact, Pumpkins is much more of a fantasy than most people give credit for, only because I've been willing to embody the role almost like an actor and sort of play different roles. Most musicians really live in fantasy. I've rarely met musicians who, as we say in wrestling, live their gimmick. Who they are, the person they are on stage is the person they're off. Nikki Sixx from Motley Crue is not the same guy off stage as he is on stage. And I've had very kind of sane dinners with Nikki, talking about everything from politics to, you know, rock and roll stupidity. Ultimately, we're really embracing really good actors. The talented are able to embody their experiences, whether they're personal or imagined, and make you feel like they themselves are having them. And, you know, maybe there's credit there to be given that it really is a fantasy game at the end of the day.
It was very nice. Oh, honey, it was paradise.
Lou Reed, Berlin. Handpicked by Billy Corgan, who joined me to Take Five back in 2012. I hope you enjoyed revisiting that one too. Next time, a new conversation from an artist we haven't heard from in a while. Emma Louise is back with a new solo album, her first in about 8 years. The story of why it took her so long and her songs of before and after, you'll hear it all when she takes five. That's next time.
Come hang out with your mates on Double J.
Loving great music is a lifelong passion. We're here to help you keep discovering. Hello, it's Michael Hing from Double J Mornings.
It's Yumi Stines here.
It's Dylan Lewis from Arvo's on Double J.
Great music lasts forever, and you'll find it on Double J. Somebody that you used to know, but you didn't
have to cut me off. We're on DAB Radio in your car, or just swipe across on the Triple J app.